You are listening to KWMR, Point Reyes Station.
Hi, good morning, and thanks for joining us on KWMR. It's a special program today about radio boys and girls. At the dawn of the 20th century, a new technology appeared called wireless. It eventually became radio broadcasting. In the 1920s, a radio craze swept the nation. People lined up to buy radio parts or complete sets. The radio craze spawned a literary genre that's largely forgotten today, radio novels aimed at boys and girls. Mike Adams is our guest this morning. He's written a book about these books, The Radio Boys and Girls, Radio, Telegraph, Telephone, and Wireless Adventures for Juvenile Readers, 1890 to 1945. Mike, thanks for joining us on KWMR.
Thank you, Richard. Thanks for having me.
Now, Mike, right at the beginning, I have to tell you, in the interest of full disclosure, I was really taken by one of the early pages in your book when you talk about your own early interest in radio, not to say obsession, Mike. And I have to say that resonated with me because you talk about the time that you came up in the 50s and what the social implications were of being a radio nerd at the time. And, Mike, I was right there with you, I have to say.
Yeah. Well, you know, Richard, we have something else in common, too, believe it or not. For 25 years, I was the faculty advisor to KSJS, which is also 90.5, one of those. We are 1,500 watts direct show in San Jose.
Oh, well, we share frequencies as well as interest.
That's right.
Wonderful, Mike. Well, I have to also say that I have on the desk in front of me and also in my personal collection several of the books that you write about. I've got Tom Swift and his motorboat here. I've got the Radio Boys on the Mexican border. Many of the books that you write about in your very interesting publication are the ones that I also have in my library.
Well, I started out with a collection of my own I've been collecting over the years. Even though I read them as a child, I kind of forgot about them for 20 or 30 years, and started collecting along with collecting radios. And then I realized I had to get the entire series of some of these. So I borrowed them and photographed them, and read them, and some are on the internet, and some I bought from used bookstores. But I tried to amass a giant collection, which I will give to the CHRS library in Alameda someday.
Yeah, we should say that's the California Historical Radio Society, who have done tremendous work and preserving radio history.
Yeah, we were up in your area about 20 years ago when they dedicated the Marconi Conference Center, and we got to stand on those concrete tower supports that Marconi did back at the turn of the century.
Well, that's right, and a lot of people, even locals here in West Marin, may not be completely aware of the rich radio history of our area. And again, in the interest of full disclosure, as you know, Mike, I'm part of the Maritime Radio Historical Society, a sister organization, you might say, to the CHRS. So all of this is just rivetingly interesting to me and also to a lot of our local residents. I've done presentations on it, and the interest, amazingly enough to me, really is there. But, Mike, before we talk about your wonderful book, we should take a look at what broadcasting was. Now, I mentioned earlier, and I think you may agree, that it really came to us at the dawn of the last century, 1901. Marconi sends that first iconic letter S across the Atlantic in Morse code.
Yes, and I did read books from that era. Can you hear me okay, by the way?
Yeah, we got you.
Okay, because you were sort of fading out. I wondered if I was fading out also. Believe it or not, I am talking on a radio, and in my book, I called the 20th century the radio century because, as you say, it started with Marconi sending between the UK and Canada in 1901 that did for S, and it ended with the device that we all hold in our hand, the cell phone, which is really just a very sophisticated radio transmitter and receiver.
That's, well, very sophisticated indeed. It's amazing when you think of what's going on inside that little box. But then just back into these early days again, this was all Morse code until Christmas Eve, 1906, Reginald Fessenden, Brant Rock, Massachusetts, broadcast his voice, much to the amazement of the ships at sea who were listening, and they'd never heard a voice come over their radio before.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, the Canadian researcher, Professor Belrose, who has been researching Fessenden, actually identified a time in 1901 when Fessenden used a spark to attempt to transmit his voice, and he attempted it at several radio and wireless conferences to replicate this. You can barely understand it, but it shows that there was a desire to do with the voice what had been done with the wired telegraph, that is, to make it wireless without wire, so go anywhere and save ships and so forth, to do the same with the wireless telephone. They didn't think about broadcasting in those early days. They really thought about how can we replace the wired telephone with something wireless, just as we have the telegraph, and they call it the radio telephone.
Yeah, that's right. And it's just interesting to us looking back from this perspective that the idea of broadcasting, which may seem obvious to us now, that took a while to mature. That really wasn't in the concept of people for quite some time, was it?
No, not at all. And as a matter of fact, we have one Bay Area example, Charles Herold, who had a radio station in San Jose in about 1912. And he had a radio, he had a wireless school. It was called the Charles Herold College of Wireless and Engineering, basically a for-profit trade school back then. And he was training young men for what happened to be one of the biggest interests. You know, like nowadays, young people want to be computer coders. Well, Charles Herold had a body of young men, maybe a few women, but mostly men who wanted to be wireless shipboard operators. And so he was training them out of school. And he said for the leisure time, they would broadcast phonograph records to their friends. And this has been documented in the Mercury, San Jose Mercury of that era, where a reporter was in the radio station in 1910 or 1911. And the kid was on the air, actually, playing using an art-based radio telephone transmitter, was playing music, and the phone would ring, and the listeners would say, play this and play that. And that's exactly what my students are doing at KSJS at San Jose, about three blocks down the street from that experience. Amazing, huh?
Well, it is. So that's, I believe, station KQW that evolved into what we now have as KCBS here in California, Northern California.
That's correct. So we have quite a history here in the San Francisco Bay Area of early radio and certainly early commercial wireless.
Well, listen, Mike, I got to tell you something about Doc Herold. You know about telegraph keys and so forth, and these certain ones that we call bugs, they have weights on them because they vibrate, right? So I had one that was an antique, and it didn't have the weight, didn't come with the weight. So in those days, there were still the small machine shops in San Francisco south of Market. So I took my design, very simple little brass weight that needed to be made, into this shop. It was a shop that had been owned for three generations. The machines were just wonderful. And the guy is making my weights. I look up on the wall, and here's these antique photographs, and here's this guy. And I say, well, who is this? He says, oh, that's Doc Herold. We used to make radio parts for him. So there I was, standing right in the machine shop that Doc Herold used.
Well, that must have been a long time ago, because in my Herold book, which was published by the same publisher as the radio voice, McFarland Publishing, in the Herold book, we go back to prior to the San Francisco earthquake, when Herold was an inventor in San Francisco, and obviously he had to build all of his devices, and they look very electricity-like. They're not really radio devices, but he was making switches, and just like some of these early books. The earliest book I read for this book was 1890, and it was called The Electrical Boys. I started there. It was written by a Harvard professor, John Trowbridge, and everything was different back then. This was the wired telegraph and the wired telephone existed. It was about 10 years or so after Edison electrified that section of New York with his new electricity. And the devices that these kids were working with were bells and buzzers and batteries.
Yeah, that's right. And it was just fascinating. For some reason, just like the technology today grasps the mind of people, the same thing happened then. We look back, and maybe it looks very simple to us, but it was cutting-edge, almost magic back in those days.
And And when you and I were growing up, what was our first device? A bell, a buzzer, a battery. I mean, I bought the big dry cells. I bought the little buzzers in the batteries and, you know, did little things with them. It wasn't all that exciting compared to broadcasting your voice, or when I was a early ham operator broadcasting crude Morse code, but that's how we started, with those batteries, buzzers, and bells.
Well, you're absolutely right. I was right there with you. So okay, now broadcasting comes along. It's actually, the idea is matured. But in the early days, interestingly enough, and you show this in your book, there's one of the many wonderful illustrations you included, by the way, that really bring it alive, shows a list of radio stations. And the thing that is hard to grasp now is that all the radio stations, the broadcast radio stations in the country, were on the same frequency. There was just one channel that they were all on.
Exactly.
833 kilocycles, we would call it today. How did that...
50 meters, I guess, right?
That's right, yes.
Well, you know, and just as a speaking of that, all being on the same frequency, I'm writing a book for Arcadia called Columbus, Ohio Radio History, because I was a radio person in Columbus, Ohio, and went to Ohio State, you know, my hometown, right? So I'm writing this book, and in the research, I have identified a piece of paper in the OSU library records called Columbus Radio Agreement. And the very crude stations in Columbus in 1922 all signed an agreement saying, here's when Morse code and continuous wave can be on. Here's when radio stations can be on. Here's when testing can occur. And they all signed on to it because, as you say, they all had to share this very limited bandwidth. And they didn't really know what they were doing, but they signed an agreement. And I suspect this probably happened in many cities.
Well, that's right, Mike. I want to get to your book. There's just one other thing I want to bring up just to give people a perspective here on this. I was looking over years at these photographs of early radio stations, just like you were. And I see here's the engineer and here's the guy talking on the microphone. Over in the corner, there's a guy. He's got earphones on. And it's labeled, he says, this is the receiving operator. Well, what is the receiving operator doing in a broadcast transmitting station? Well, he's listening on 600 meters for any SOSs that may occur. Mm-hmm. So the broadcast station can go off the air in case that there is a distress call coming in. What a concept.
And they were legally required to do that. They
right.
had to monitor and get out of the way of emergency communications, which sounds fair.
Yep. Well, we're talking to Mike Adams, and the subject really is his book. It's called The Radio Boys and Girls, Radio, Telegraph, Telephone, and Wireless Adventures for Juvenile Readers, 1890 to 1945. Now, I've read some of these books, Mike. They're just, in a way, riveting, but how would you describe the writing style of these things?
Well, it all changed. I mean, they all had different kinds of thrusts. For example, I divided them into eras, and I called the first era electricity and wired communication, approximately 1890 to 1910. In the writing style was a little bit Horatio Alger-ish, because in the end, the radio or the electrical boy rises up through several social classes and succeeds because he has impressed a wealthy capitalist. And there's also, in these books, there's a lack of social services. There are a lot of homeless kids on the street in the big cities, and they have to steal food, and they have to, you know, become apprenticed to electricians to manage to eat. And sometimes in several of these books, the electrician who took on a boy as an apprentice, gave him a place to sleep and, you know, bread and water and that sort of thing. So the social milieu was totally different prior to the early 1900s, because we were just industrializing as a country. Some of the writing, it's all over the place. Some of these writers are brilliant, and the stories are really interesting, and the writing is very good. Some of the writing is dreadful, and they misuse some of the terms that we understand about radio and wireless and electricity and electronics. They don't really understand it because, again, these writers are from all over the place. Most of them were educated. I found a Harvard professor. I found two school deans. I found several ordained ministers, as was Horatio Alger Jr., who died about 1899, I believe. He did write a telegraph story, but he was educated. Most of these people had other jobs. They were reporters or itinerant journalists or independent writers.
Now, you talk about the boys in these books rising up through social strata, but in the later ones that I'm familiar with, like the Radio Boys, those characters seem to come from very privileged backgrounds.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, there are five Radio Boys series that I identified, all written in 1922. That's when the series started. If it was successful, it continued to the 20s. But a couple of them were very well off. The Radio Boys, written by Gerald Breckinridge, who was a New York newspaper editor. His Radio Boys had airplanes and cars, and they were extremely wealthy and lived on the tip of Long Island in a big mansion. All of these, by the way, were East Coast based, pretty much. Another group of Radio Boys were solidly middle class. The Radio Girls in 1922 were above average in wealth and status. Their fathers were lawyers who went to New York to make money every day, and their mothers, of course, were stay at home mothers. But there's a lot going on in these stories. A lot of family and a lot of social issues, and you know, everything from xenophobia to racism to gay bashing is found in these stories, believe it or not. And I didn't see that when I was a kid. I saw only adventure and stories about radio when I was growing up, but I didn't see all of these social issues.
Now, one of the things that I learned immediately when I opened your book that was unknown to me was that not only were there Radio Boy books, there were Radio Girl books. Now, in the Radio Boys and similar series, those guys are busy rescuing shipwrecked people and saving people all over the place. What did the Radio Girls do in these books?
Well, the Radio Girls didn't last very long. When the Radio Boys had a series of about 10 or 12 or 13, depending on which series it was, and they seemed to be popular, the Radio Girls only lasted four volumes. And they did the same thing, basically, that the Radio Boys did in those early volumes. That is, in volume one, they built a crystal set, and they did what was called back then listening in. They would tune around and listen to music, and there was a lot of aw, gee whiz. You know, I can read some of what they said here. Eventually, we get to that. Then in the second volume of the Radio Boys and Radio Girls from 1922, it was called At the Sending Station, where they actually went to a radio station and did things. They did bird calls. They read poetry. They sang. Obviously, early radio's content was the content of all the media that was already existing and already mature. There was vaudeville on radio. There was ventriloquism on radio, if you could imagine that. It's kind of why in the 1950s, when we see Edgar Bergen on TV with Charlie McCarthy, we realize that he's not a very good ventriloquist, and his lips move, and you see them. But on radio, it worked. And so everything in early radio, the singing, the dancing, and the bird calls were all from what happened before.
Well, another thing I learned is that a lot of these books were written under pseudonyms and that there was a syndicate. In fact, you mentioned Edward Stratemeyer, a major syndicate for the producer of these books, but the authors almost rotated through in several cases.
Yes, Stratemeyer began working as a contract writer in the late 1800s. He actually worked for Horatio Alger Jr. and apparently finished some of his stories when Alger died. Stratemeyer controlled things with an iron hand. He would hire a writer who was maybe an itinerant journalist, and he would give them an outline and saying, give me 190 pages on this. And if it was satisfactory, he'd get $50, and he had to use a house name. Stratemeyer was responsible for Tom Swift. There were about 40 Tom Swift stories written by a variety of contract writers under the name Victor Appleton. The Nancy Drew series was also App was also Stratemeyer's, as was the Hardy Boys, and a bunch of others too. But the Radio Boys and Girls, the most popular of those two series, were from the Stratemeyer Syndicate and did have pseudonyms writing them. As a matter of fact, the Radio Girls had a woman listed as the author, but it was really a man who wrote the books.
You know, you and I share this history. I wonder if you share this as well, because I remember coming up this genre in a way, in sort of a little bit different way, but still continued up into the 1960s, because at least I was an avid reader, of course, of popular electronics magazine.
And Jerry, that's right.
Carl and Jerry were there every month, and they had a radio adventure. And those of us radio-obsessed kids, of course, occupying the bottom rung of the social ladder, were all grubbing around with radios and all this other stuff. But we were arguing, well, are you Jerry or are you Carl? Which one are you?
Yeah.
But it was fascinating, and I wonder if you see a direct lineage to that.
Oh, of course. I couldn't wait for the next issue of Popular Electronics and Carl and Jerry, written by John T. Fry, who I believe is probably not alive anymore, but... that was very exciting, and it was about 3 or 4 page story of two guys, you know, like we would be. I had a few radio friends with fellow geeks, and we were sort of shunned by girls and by proper high school society, but you know, we enjoyed our life at that time.
Well, it's an interesting thing you mentioned that, because certainly that was the case. You know, I was on the projector squad. I was in the radio club, all of that.
Projectors, yeah.
All of that great bottom rung, as I say, social strata stuff. But, you know, it's interesting. I wonder, the stuff that's grabbing the minds of younger people today, mainly their smartphones and their computers, and when they come and see the Morse code station we restored here in Point Reyes, we expected originally that we would absolutely bomb. Why would they be interested in a bunch of old geezers running around with Morse code and radios with tubes in them? But it turns out that it's absolutely not the case. They're fascinated, especially, I have to say, the little girls. That was a revelation. The little girls are just superb at Morse code. We give them this little key and off they go.
Wow. Yeah.
So it's just... It's just wonderful.
I only got up to 5 words a minute technician license in the 50s and let it expire because I really wanted to be in show business. I wanted to be on the radio like I am now, you know, talking to people and playing records and, you know, saying what I wanted to say.
Yeah, there's just something about the medium. Whatever area you go into it at, it grabs you and... once that bug bites, there's just no way out.
Well, thinking about a kid who wanted to perhaps have a career as a wireless boy, I have a quote from one of the books. One of the apprentices says to the boy, "There is a good chance for a live young fellow in a business that can send a message hundreds of miles in a few seconds. The business is now only in its infancy, and those who get in first have the best chance." And this is... this is one of those from those 1914 or 15 books when wireless was a big career for boys. And so these were kind of being promoted. You mentioned Tom Swift, and the one Tom Swift I did was Tom Swift and his wireless message. And he is saving all these people on an island by building a wireless set from parts from a crashed airplane that he was flying, experimental airplane. Tom Swift, of course, science fantasy. And he builds a wireless set, even though we know by reading it he doesn't really have the complete parts. But he builds a set, and he is rescued. And this book was written in, published at least, the date is 1911, and the ship operator says, you know, when that awful wreck occurred last year, the operator was just about to take the receiver from his head when he caught the call. 1 minute later, and he wouldn't have heard it, and over 800 people would have been lost. And he's saying the same thing to Tom Swift. He said, well, it's a good thing because... had it just been a few minutes, he would have retired for the night and the wireless turned off. Now, this was all about the Titanic, which was never mentioned in any of these books that I read.
Yeah, and of course, those who are students of that incident know that that's exactly the situation that occurred.
Yeah, and Tom Swift apparently was pressing because he solved it, at least publication date-wise, a year before the Radio Act of 1912 required 24-hour wireless monitoring.
Yep, that's right. And so these books are available. I see them all over. And yeah, I'm just wondering.
You can get them probably on the internet. Used to be, well, back in the day when we had used bookstores, and I live in the Santa Cruz area, so we had some used bookstores down here. There was one in Los Gatos where I bought a bunch of them years ago, which the store does not exist anymore. I don't see them, though. I get the feeling that most of them are in the hands of collectors right now.
Well, would you say that they're tough to find? It seemed to me they were available and not too expensive.
Okay. Well, this may have all changed because in the past 10 or so years, you may have noticed that the collection of old radios and the collection of radio literatures and books seems to have peaked maybe 10 years ago. And right now, I don't see as much interest. You know, we see it in the small number of people who attend the flea markets. We see it in the publication Antique Radio Classified, which doesn't exist anymore, just quit publishing a year or so ago, just sort of died out. And we see it, you know, in the what used to be the radio collecting genre, which included literature. I see less interest in it anyway.
Well, Mike, it's been a fascinating half hour. We're just about out of time here, but I do want to remind folks of your book, which chronicles and analyzes these wonderful radio adventure books for juveniles that were published in the 20s. The name of Mike's book is The Radio Boys and Girls, Radio, Telegraph, Telephone, and Wireless Adventures for Juvenile Readers, 1890 to 1945.
Now, could I just insert, I did a website for it, which gives some more photos and more information about these chapters. And the website is radioboysandgirls.org, radioboysandgirls.org, and it explains the book.
radioboysandgirls.org. Go there. Yeah. Find this book. It's worth a read. Mike, thank you so much for taking time this morning.
Thank you, Richard.
This is KWMR. I'm Richard Dillman. Thanks for joining us.